Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
Bronislaw Huberman was born in Poland, 1882. At the age of 14, he performed a Brahms violin concerto in front of Brahms himself. And as some say, that after that, the rest was history. He was eventually established worldwide as an international star violinist. And because of his fame and living in Germany at the time, he started receiving communications from Adolf Hitler. And although it was prior to World War II, he suddenly realized that himself being Jewish and many of the musicians being Jewish in Europe at that time, that they had danger approaching, the Holocaust. He could see it coming. So he saw the dark side of the Nazi regime starting to develop at an earlier than most people saw it. And he decided that he was going to rescue some of the best Jewish musicians from Europe. And so through his career as a musician, he vowed to save the lives of at least the best Jewish musicians that he could find in Europe. And the end result was over 1,000 Jewish musicians and their families in total, including people from Germany, Austria, Poland, and Hungary, immigrated out of Europe to Palestine. Of course, he went through auditions trying to determine who were the absolutely best musicians. And part of his goal was to set up a world-class symphony orchestra in Palestine, which at that point, some of you know history, was not really a country. It was a territory that was administered by Great Britain along with Syria. And so immigrating to that part of the world was not something that everybody wanted to do. He had many things that he had to do. He had to raise money for this. He had 42 benefit concerts in the U.S. that he held to raise money to pay for the travel expenses. He capped off that event, one of the events that year, with a special dinner that was hosted by Albert Einstein. Einstein was a violinist, and he and Huberman were good friends. Einstein was doing everything that he could to help Huberman's mission. It's interesting that much of the money he raised for this effort came from the U.S., which at the time was not allowing refugees from Europe into its borders. But through individuals, people were funding this effort that Huberman had begun. One of the later concerts that year was at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Huberman was out playing. He had several violins. And backstage, someone came in and stole his Stradivarius violin. He never saw that violin again. 50 years later, it was recovered. And actually, Joshua Bell, who now is a world-class violinist, purchased that same violin for $4 million and plays it today. And so, on December 26, 1936, the Palestine Symphony Orchestra had its first concert in Tel Aviv. You can see here this program, photo in the program, were autographed by Huberman himself, as well as by Arturo Toscanini, a world-class conductor. He had refused to play in Germany because of the Holocaust, and Huberman felt it would be appropriate for him to conduct the first concert of this orchestra. During the concert, Huberman refused to play himself. He did not want to take away the glory from the orchestra itself and from the people who had moved out of Europe. A few years later, in 1948, the State of Israel was officially created. Country of Israel, and the orchestra was renamed to the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. So what is so special about Huberman's achievement? I would argue he had a unique position due to his world fame and the ability to raise money and understand governments. He had friends in the right places. He could see what Hitler was intending to do. He was able to raise money. He was able to argue for visas. It turned out that Great Britain stopped all permanent visas just at the time when members were immigrating for the orchestra, and he was able to speak at high places to get that policy reversed so those people could reside permanently in Palestine. Yes, he was a great musician, and he was a great violinist, but he was called to help others. And I think today, if we were to really remember him for what he did, it would be for saving those 1,000 European families, people that were families of musicians and the musicians themselves from the Holocaust. We hear about Schindler's List today, and that's many people know about that. There is no such thing as Huberman's List, but probably there should be. The key message of this story, I think, is he used his unique position to do something good, to save world-class musicians that had an uncertain fate because of their nationality. And I think there's a message today for us as well, that each of us is in a unique position to do something special. It may not be saving musicians from the Holocaust, but there's other people around us that need to be saved as well. We each have a unique position that only we have. The Bible has many examples of people that were called to help others. And I think when you look at it, it's sort of surprising sometimes that some of these people don't look like they were the ones that maybe God should have chosen. Let me give you a couple examples. Let's talk about Jonah. Jonah, of course, well, let's turn to it, actually. The little tiny book of Jonah, I'll give you a second to find it. We're going to start right at the beginning, Jonah 1, verse 1, which is the beginning of this story. Okay, Jonah 1, verse 1. It says, "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me.' But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa, found a ship going to Tarshish, so he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord." I think all of us know this story of Jonah and the great fish. But sometimes it's easy to forget that Jonah did not want to help the people that God wanted him to help. You look at the simple geography, he was going the wrong direction. He was going west and he should have been going east to get to Nineveh. He was going exactly the opposite direction. He was trying to get away from God and trying to get away from his responsibility to help others. And we jump clear to the end of the story, right? We'll skip the story about the fish and all the stuff and all the preaching. We get to the end of the story, Jonah 3, verse 10. I'll start there. "Then God saw that their heart, that their works," this is the people of Nineveh, "that they turned from their evil way, and God relented from disaster that he had said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it." I mean, this is pretty clear evidence that the ministry of Jonah was successful. But then we have the really big surprise here. Continue in chapter 4. It says, "But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to the Lord and said, 'Ah, Lord, was not this what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live.'" Was he happy that his work had saved these people? Was Jonah a willing helper to these people? Did he still help them? He did. With a bad attitude. He didn't want to do what God told him to do. He didn't want to help these people. In fact, he still did help them, and after he was done helping them, he was mad that God had repented and wasn't going to destroy them. The whole book has sort of strange things in it, but you look at the beginning and the end, in this context of helping others, God asked him to help others, and he did not want to do it, and after he had helped them, he was mad that he had helped them. Is there any bigger example of someone who did not want to help somebody, and God used them still? There are some other ones. Let's talk about Balaam. This is one of my favorites. Let's look up Numbers 22:22. A little bit of history here. There was a king of the Moabites. His name was Balak. The names are sort of similar here. He wanted God's prophet Balaam to come and curse the children of Israel. He wanted the prophet to do bad stuff. And he was willing to give Balaam a whole bunch of money to do this. And Balaam sort of waffled, do I really want it? I really want the money. I know God wouldn't want me to do this. He was a prophet. He was ordained by God to do good things for God's people, all right? And he's having this tough time deciding whether he's going to actually give in and take the money from Balak and go and curse the people. So we have this fantastic story that we learn as little kids, but when you put it in context, this is just an extraordinary story. Let's pick up the story in Numbers 22:22, and you know, Balaam finally has decided, well, okay, I'm going to go. God wasn't particularly happy. In fact, verse 22 says, then God's anger was aroused because Balaam went. And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And he, that's Balaam, was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. Now the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. So Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back onto the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. Then we come to the astounding part of the story. Then the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn, either to the right or to the left. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam's anger was aroused, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, what have I done to you that you have struck me these three times? I'll stop reading there, but Balaam goes on and talks back to the donkey like nothing unusual is happening. Now the donkey is talking to him, asking why he's doing this. And of course, the rest of the story, King Balak tries to get Balaam to curse children of Israel four times. And each time, good things come out of his mouth. Ultimately, a little further in the story, they come up with another plan that really is deadly for the children of Israel. But at this point, God is not allowing him to say bad things about them, even though Balak wants to give him money. Is this a person that's committing to helping God's people? Did God use this person still? God made words of blessing come out of his mouth, and Balak was beside himself that this was happening. God was using someone who was really trying to do evil to still help other people. So we've got some examples here of people that did not want to help other people, and God still used them. We've got other kinds of examples in the Bible. Let's talk about Moses just for a second. We won't look at the text, but you know the story. Moses in the bulrushes, he was protected. He ended up being educated in the Egyptian court. Pharaoh's daughter had come and rescued him. He learns all the military secrets, all the strategy, all the ability to rule and to lead, and takes things into his own hands, kills one of the Egyptians, has to flee for a good many years. God comes to him in the burning bush and says, Moses, it's time for you to go save your people. Was Moses jumping up and down to go do that? No. In fact, he said, I can't speak the language. I don't know how to talk to the people in the court. God sent Aaron to help him. And eventually, we know the rest of the story. Moses became a tremendous leader of God's people. But very reluctantly, because he wasn't confident. Perhaps God needed a person like that wasn't overconfident. That'd be an interesting thing to talk to God about someday. Why? What was involved in choosing Moses, and what did God really want him to do? But again, an example of someone who felt uncomfortable helping others, felt insufficient, felt not confident that he could help them. The last example I'll give you is Paul. You should really start by talking about Saul, right? Was Saul a nice guy? Okay, he was going around doing what? Killing the Christians, all right? Why would God choose him to be the person that would help so many people? And we all know there was a tremendous experience he had where God challenged him on the road to Damascus, and he had a conversion experience. He understood, and he studied, and he learned that he had been making a mistake, and he became probably one of the greatest ministers, if we want to call that, of all time. I mean, we read some of his writings for our scripture lesson today. So we have examples where God chose people to do things to help others, where there are all sorts of reasons why those people weren't. Maybe it wouldn't seem like the best choices. I think there's an obvious message for us, right? Do we always feel confident? Do we always feel like we're the right person? You look at those stories, and maybe we need to rethink. When God calls us to do something, maybe he has a reason. Maybe he will help make up for the differences, the things that we feel not confident about or whatever. He will be there to help us. So let's talk a little bit about churches and church families. Let's go back to our scripture text. Cindy, thanks for reading that. 1 Corinthians 12:12. I love the colorful language that's in this description here. And I want us to think about it a little bit. Starting with verse 12, 1 Corinthians 12, verse 12. For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, have all been made to drink into one Spirit, where in fact the body is not one member, but many. Now we can stop there and you could say, well, what a tremendous thought on diversity. Geographic diversity, people that have come together for different reasons. What a powerful message that God needs diverse people in his church. And I wouldn't argue that that's part of the message, but what does it say next? It's using this analogy of the body. It says, if the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I'm not part of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? So let's translate this. What if everybody in our church only liked to preach? What would happen? That's every one of you here, the only thing you like to do in this church is preach. It's the only thing you're willing to do. The only gift that you have. We'd have some trouble, right? Who would get the roof fixed? Who would prepare the potluck food? Who would lead a children's division? I could go on a long list. What if everybody was only willing to preach, we'd have a huge problem. And you could make all sorts of other analogies. Pick your favorite thing to do in the church. If everybody else wanted to do the same thing, we would be in big trouble. But that's just a simple translation, I think, of what Paul was telling the Corinthian church, that you can't all be ears. The body would be in big trouble if you were all ears. You wouldn't be able to see anything. You wouldn't be able to hear anything. Or you'd be able to hear if you're all ears, but you wouldn't be able to smell anything. It's a very simple, but it's a powerful message. These texts teach that in the church there are many, many tasks and many skills, and every one of them is important. I think we lose sight of that sometimes. Let me challenge your thinking a little bit. Dan Chase, Dan was heavily influenced by 3ABN in his walk with Jesus. And when that transmitter goes down, Dan calls me up, says, let's get out there and see if we can fix this thing. We've gone out there a number of times, sometimes together, sometimes Dan separately. So far, we've always been able to fix it. Dan takes that personally in his heart because it made a difference in his life. He wants that ministry to be available to other people. He takes that one seriously. You know, Greg and Dick, along with some other people, you love to keep our grounds around our church looking nice. That is an important service to others. Would you visit a grungy-looking church? Probably not. All right? It's important. You know, Mark Yates, I love having him in our class. You know, he, I don't know if you noticed, he gets here early, almost every Sabbath. And if there's something needs to be done, he helps shovel the sidewalk, put some salt out. He's handing out bulletins, welcoming people. He's here because he wants to help. We appreciate that, Mark. The things that you do are important services to others. You know, Carol and Richard Rose, I don't see them here today. About a month ago, they had a Vesper program on the importance of memorizing Scripture. A fantastic Vesper program. It was a wonderful service to others. So I ask the question again, what if everybody was only willing to work on the 3ABN transmitter? What if everybody was only willing to plant flowers around the church? And what if everybody only wanted to have Vespers programs on memorizing Scripture? Our church would be, it would be crazy. Fortunately, that's not the way it is. God gives gifts to all of us, puts us all in unique places so that we can do things that are very special, unique ministries. Every one of them is important. It's not like this one here, well, he's up in front, so that's a little more important than that one back there. They're all important. If one of them isn't happening, we have problems in our church. There's something missing. So the more I thought about this, I think one of the primary, not the only, but one of the primary missions of our church is really to enable and facilitate people helping others. And we need to broaden our definitions of what that means, because some people do things that we don't think are that important, but they are important. So I came up with four challenges, maybe for you to think about. I don't know if these are spectacularly good ones or not, but maybe one will be helpful to you. Number one, when you're doing your own personal ministry, whatever it is, pray for it, preferably while you're doing it. Remember, our sons teaching or being counselors and workers up at Camp Asabo. I'm pretty sure this is still done. Before the campers arrive at the beginning of the summer, they go out to the various locations around camp, out to the campfire circle, out to the fort, down to the beach, down out to the wagon train. They send groups out and they spend time praying that that summer, that particular area will be a wonderful ministry to the campers. You say, well, doesn't God already know about that? I think he does, but when he hears us say, Father, the people that come to this wagon train, and we have a Vespers out here, I want it to touch their hearts. Help them to be attentive. Help us to be a ministry that's effective here at this wagon train. And so, pick on Don Ervick. Don, when you come in on Friday to turn up the heat in here because it takes a while to turn up. Why not give a little prayer that what happens in this church will be a blessing to people because people are warm and they're not distracted. All right? Seems like a small thing, but if Don didn't do that, we would have a problem. Maybe you're home preparing your favorite casserole dish for a potluck. And, you know, it's time, you don't have much time, it's a little stressful, it's not going quite right. Why not pray over that casserole dish? Something like, God, we've got people in here that don't get really delicious meals very often. Help them to enjoy this food. And by the way, as they eat it, help them to hear about Jesus from the people around them. What a wonderful thing to pray. It reminds us that the thing that we're doing is special. It's helping others, and it needs God's blessing. It's not something we do for ourselves. It's something that we do because it's a ministry to help others. Number one. So that was number one. Pray for your own personal ministry. Number two. Try something new that you always wanted to do. I mean, there's lots of things that we need to have done. But maybe there's something that you always wanted to do that you never found the time to do it. Maybe make a decision to really, maybe it's a small thing, maybe it's a big thing, maybe it's a series of things. Test God out and say, hey, I'm going to really try to do, I've always wanted to do this particular thing. I always thought it would be a blessing to people. Just go and do it. Okay? And if the church can help you, praise God. I mean, we've talked about glow tracks as something that you can do. If you always wanted to do ministry, but it was a little challenging, you were afraid, that's an option. We need help at our school. We have field trips, Bible labs. People need to, it's nice to have snacks for the kids sometimes. There's all sorts of things happen at the school. Talk to Dorothy Dalton. If you'd like to visit somebody, Dorothy's family ministry person for our church. She knows what's happening in almost all of our families where there's needs, lonely people, people that can't come to church regularly. Ask Dorothy for a suggestion if you'd like to visit somebody like that. Talk to Jeff Coates. He's not here. I can use his name. But if you feel like fixing something, I'm sure he has a list of things that are just waiting for somebody to do. Talk to Jeff also if you'd like to do something for a shut-in, some sort of a fix it for them, which can be a big blessing. Maybe you'd like to study the Bible some. Talk to Pedro. He has a short list of people that are interested in giving Bible studies. We're working hard to get some names to match up with those people. I don't know what the special thing you'd like to do is. It's probably not on that list because it's something special to you. But number two is to try something new that you've always wanted to do. Number three, I couldn't leave this one out at this time of the year, but I will say it anyway. Consider requests from the Ministry Placement Committee seriously. Committee's working hard. It's asking people. Let God speak to your heart. Doesn't mean you say yes to everything, but if the committee thinks that you would be have some talents in a particular area and could be a blessing to other people, take that seriously. No, really consider it. And number four, perhaps the most difficult, but perhaps very important, I call it enjoy the team spirit, God's team spirit. And by that I mean, don't be afraid to get involved in one of our big church projects. You know, right now we've got evangelistic meetings going. Drew Weaver's worked hard to pull together an army of people to help out all the little bits and pieces of that. It is a big team effort. And it feels good to work in a team like that. You know, sometimes if you've ever gone to a sports stadium, your favorite team is there, and maybe they just need it, you know, one more touchdown to win the game and win some sort of a title. And they're getting close. Everybody stands up. Everybody's cheering. And maybe they wave. And, you know, there's people are yelling at this quarterback to do this, even though they know they can't be heard. And there is just an electricity there of people wanting their team to win. Well, I can tell you a secret that may seem exciting and may seem electric and invigorating, but when you're on a team working for God, it is a far better feeling even. It may not be quite the same feeling, but wow. It is a special feeling to know that you work with a group of other people to minister to somebody, something, somewhere that made a difference. It's a huge blessing to be on a team like that. So one of my dreams for our church, we all have dreams for our church family, is that we can have a strong team spirit work together. We don't do everything together, but we do things regularly together. We feel it like a team, God's team. So a quick summary. Number one, pray for your personal ministry, your own special personal ministry, preferably as you do it. Number two, try something new that you always wanted to do. Three, consider requests of Ministry Placement Committee seriously. And four, enjoy the feeling of working with God's team. Just some ideas for your consideration. And when I talked about this, thought about this sermon, and I tried to come up with a title. And the serving others was sort of a no-brainer. But I struggled. What is the benefit that we want to tap into? And I chose the words God's breathtaking gift. Breathtaking maybe is a funny word, but I thought it captured the spirit. When you really are serving others, God is giving you a gift, a benefit of helping others. It gives you a good feeling. It gives you a feeling of being close to God. It's a gift, all right? And I like to think it's a breathtaking gift. I'd like to tell you a story. This is a story that comes from Denver, Colorado. And it actually comes from Porter Adventist Hospital, which is run by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, a very large hospital, lots of expert care in the Denver area. And more specifically, takes place on the first floor of this wing here, the Cancer Care Center. This is sort of a sad story. I hope I can get through without shedding a tear or two. But also it illustrates the marvelous benefit of people helping others. So I'd like to leave this story in your mind as you think about this sermon. The story is written by David Peterson, and it actually appeared in the Huffington Post. May 14, 2014. When this was published. And it's called A Love Letter to Angels. David Peterson lives in Durango, Colorado area, which is southwestern Colorado, the far western side of the state from Denver. I'm going to read parts of this story too, because I don't think I could tell it as well as he wrote it. And it's a story about David and his wife, Carolyn. This is what he says. This has been a tough one to wrap the right words around. Remember, this is written in the Huffington Post, a public article. I've written overly long essays involving extensive research in far less time. Problem is, this is about the recent death of my wife of 36 years, Carolyn Jane Sturgis Peterson. Carolyn was my fount of strength, sanity, heart, and mindfulness in this warped old world. And her disappearance leaves me a man cut in half. As we grew older together, she turned 59 on the winter solstice, and I turned 68 this month. Our bond grew ever stronger. Things were so sweet in our lives and love that recently I quipped offhand to her, "This can't last." And it did. It did not last. In fact, Carolyn had been treated for a melanoma cancer about 16 years prior to this. Thought that she was in full remission. And then the cancer returned with a vengeance. She had stomach cramps, went to the Durango Hospital. They ran some tests. The next morning, the doctor came to talk to them. How long, I asked the doctor. Weeks, a few months maybe. At that point, had I been discerning, I'd have taken my wife home to fade and die in dignity. We'd always promised ourselves we wouldn't die in some cold and steely hospital. But once you fall under the humming spell of the medical machine, hope and desperation impart a functional insanity that makes it all but impossible to escape. And so it was we did not argue when the doctor urged that Carolyn be air evacuated immediately to Porter Adventist Hospital in Denver, where we were assured she would receive care from one of the best liver cancer surgeons in the country. He goes on to write, "With that compressed background, we reach my motivation for inflicting this personal tragedy on you. This is an open love letter to Porter Avenue Hospital in general, and specifically the people who staff the first floor oncology unit." Carolyn's room at Mercy Medical Center in Durango had been tiny, hardly enough room for one chair, and a single small window set back in a recess so that little natural light was admitted. Although clean and modern, the space was dark, claustrophobic, and foreboding. In contrast, her room at Porter was downright spacious, furnished with 5 chairs and room enough to dance, had we been up to it. I especially appreciated the full wall of windows through which I watched the sun rise each of the 9 mornings I was there. Following fitful nights on a cot beside Carolyn's bed, or toward the end in bed with her. While bright and cheery seems like an oxymoron for a hospital room, that's just what it was. And likewise, the medical staff. One would expect that working daily with death, as oncology specialists do, would prompt the formation of an emotional exoskeleton. Miraculously, we found that not to be so at Porter. Carolyn had been awake and characteristic engaging the first couple of days, all light and innocence, even with morphine. This brief conscious prelude allowed the nursing staff to get a better sense of her irresistible lovability and unflinching stoicism. Like I had years before, they all fell instantly in love. And too, at only 59, Carolyn was a generation younger than most terminal cancer patients, providing another source of "this isn't fair" empathy. But the exceptional personal compassion we saw in the Porter oncology staff was obviously resident there long before we arrived. These were not mere professional smiles greeting us at every turn, but the real deal from real people, at times accompanied by real tears. Death Watch nurses crying. I could name them here, but I won't. One sweet lady visited our room frequently every night she worked, lingering there. Assuming that I was asleep, she went about her duties, such as assuring that the morphine drip was functioning and far beyond, bathing my comatose wife with a cool damp cloth, turning her gently, applying ointment to eyes and lips, speaking to her quietly and lovingly throughout, and like me, weeping. And more, including the star surgeon we had come there for help, who was clearly grieved that he'd been unable to save my wife, and his assistant in the surgical waiting room, who cheerily stayed an extra 2 hours overtime. No extra pay, just to keep me company. A volunteer massage therapist who, like two of the nurses, told me she was dedicating her life to oncology patients after having lost a loved one to cancer, and others, each and all, so very special. On Thursday morning, April 17, Carolyn died gently. Having been comatose for several days, her tough little mountain girl heart unwilling to take a hint. At my request, the palliative care team went to work, clearing the way for me to take Carolyn home to Durango for a dignified cremation on Good Friday by the local family-owned mortuary, thus alleviating what had been my greatest fear since arriving in Denver, that my beloved would suffer the final indignity of being hauled off to some industrial big city barbecue, leaving me forever doubtful that the ashes I received were even hers. Thanks to the passionate ladies of Porter's palliative team, my drive home to Durango with Carolyn, 7 hours of scenic back roads over the divide from Denver to Durango, allowed me to make critical emotional accommodations. While I'll remain a man cut in half the rest of my days, had it not been for that last road trip together, that sacred private time surrounded always by nature's healing grandeur, I may not be here today. Compassion had trumped bureaucracy, something we don't dare expect from hospital staff. Now catch these last two statements. We are atheists, Carolyn and me. Yet the loving care we received at Porter throughout the most stressful and disorienting week of our lives was nothing less than a blessing. Even as the staff who exceptionally serve and comfort us are angels come to earth. Would an atheist talk about angels? Angels come to earth. My fondest wish is that you never have to see the inside of an oncology unit as patient or survivor. Yet should it come to that, give thanks for Porter Adventist Hospital, a godsend, pure and simple. True ministry touches the hearts and lives of others. And as we've said earlier in this church, the skills of every single person are important. The ministry of every person is important. And so we ask the question, why really is ministry such a breathtaking gift from God? Jesus himself said it. Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.